Whoa. Sorry. I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting to order. It's Thursday, April 18th, 2024. Time now is 3:30 p.m. We are in the Belts Committee room in Juneau, Alaska, the state capitol. I'd like to welcome Senator Merrick, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Bjorkman, and myself, Chair Kawasaki. Senator Klayman will be on his way shortly. I wanted to thank Savannah Danberg from Senate Records and Shelby Carroll, the moderator with the Legislative Information Office. Let's see. We are going to start first with House Bill 146, dealing with the regulation of fireworks. It is by rules, by request of the governor. This is the first hearing of the House bill. We did hear a similar bill that was the Senate bill relating to regulation of fireworks. This is one that's come across, and we do have a State Affairs Committee substitute from the House. I'd like for, looks like we have Lisa Purinton here and Mark Bronice, the Assistant Fire Marshal from the Department of Public Safety. I'm not sure who's starting first. If you could just come forward, state your name and your affiliation for the record. Welcome you to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki and members of the House State Affairs, or excuse me, Senate State Affairs Committee. Lisa Purinton, for the record, with Department of Public Safety, acting legislative liaison for the department. I'm here with the Assistant State Fire Marshal. Let him introduce himself.
Good afternoon, Chairman Kawasaki. My name is Mark Bronis, for the record, and I have the privilege of serving as the Assistant State Fire Marshal within the Department of Public Safety.
So with, as you mentioned, Chair Kawasaki, this bill was previously heard as a companion bill under SB 117 back in January. This bill was slightly modified in the House State Affairs Committee. It basically changed the word any and placed the word a to add specificity as it relates to the buildings that the Department of Public Safety could go into for reviewing for potential violations of the fireworks law. So the we plan to just do a quick refresher since it's been a little while since we've heard the bill, and we'll have the Assistant State Fire Marshal will give the brief overview of the bill, and we're happy to go back in and do the summary of changes from version A to version B, or to do a sectional analysis if that's the will of the committee. So, thank you.
Thank you.
For the record again, Mark Bronis, Assistant State Fire Marshal. Brief overview of the bill is this bill repeals statutory restrictions on the sale of fireworks as defined in AS 1872 currently, a statute that is 50 plus years old, and it directs the Department of Public Safety to adopt fireworks regulations in its place, essentially moving substantive rules relating to the sale, storage, and use of fireworks from statute to regulation. This affects the regulation of sales in licensing, regulation, and expanding definitions of nationally approved fireworks. Few examples of what this regulation would allow for is it would give us the flexibility to eliminate archaic language, again 50 plus years old, that's no longer used in the industry and is a huge limitation on industry to match what's current versus what's in effect in state statute. Giving an example is the words dangerous fireworks is now subdivided at a federal level as well as nationally into two separate display grade and pest control fireworks. It's more specific now than what the current statute shows, as well as it breaks down saleable into consumer grade, which makes more sense when people are going out to purchase consumer grade fireworks. It makes sense that the words match. Again, we get to eliminate inconsistencies within federal regulations or state statutes, inconsistencies with federal regulations, national consensus standards, and the industry best practices. Examples I could reflect on there, again, is currently our statute only reflects 11 approved forms of fireworks, consumer fireworks. Well, that was okay 50 years ago. However, to date, There are now 42 nationally recognized in federal regulation fireworks. We go from one page, one column, legal column of details on how those fireworks are manufactured and sold to over 100 pages. So just in 50 years, it's changed substantially. The regulation would allow us to be a little more nimble as those numbers fluctuate to address that in real time as opposed to, you know, half a millennium or several decades anyways. Mm. When adopted 50 plus years ago, the statute only identified two different regulatory agencies that were the umbrella over fireworks. We're now at seven, and they all share different levels of purview, and a regulation would allow for us to adopt and adapt to those overlaps as opposed to a statute where we'd have to keep coming back on a 3 to 5 year basis. Additionally, there's a number of revision schedules, and trying to maintain parity and relevance is near impossible at the rate things are moving. Finally, in developing this regulation, the Department of Public Safety will partner with all interested parties and stakeholders throughout the development project to ensure relevance and a sustainable level of efficiency in managing both display and consumer fireworks throughout Alaska. We respectfully urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Bronice. Are there any questions for either Ms. Purinton or Mr. Bronice at this time? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill came before us several months ago, and there was, I think, fairly substantial concerns over the changes, particularly the repealer language. And it looks like none of those concerns have been addressed in the CS. And I'll just talk to you about some of the things that are being repealed. There's 1872-020 is being repealed. That's requirements for liability insurance. There's which is a substantial concern I think many members of the committee had. There's 1872, and I'm referring to line 26 on page 2, the three repealers. These are huge changes. There's the fireworks wholesaler's license provision that's being changed. The whole definition section is being changed. And I think we heard from one the largest state supplier of fireworks that it could simply be fixed by changing some of the definitions. So I don't understand why there haven't been any, why this committee's concerns have not been addressed at all.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, for the record, Lisa Purinton, to the senator's question, these are all the repealer language, all the information that will be repealed out of the statute. Is the plan is to address that in the regulations, to actually add those definitions in the regulations
What you do in regulation, I can't control. I can control, and this committee and this body can control what you do, what we set as state policy and statute. I have no idea what's going to happen with regulations. That's completely out of this body's control once it leaves, once this bill passes. And I've heard people say many times over the years, oh, we'll fix it in regulations. We'll do this in regulations. We'll just go ahead and do this. And sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. So I think this is taking a sledgehammer to a problem that can be fixed with a scalpel. That's my personal opinion.
Great. Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Do you have any comments to make on that?
I don't. I would defer to the state. Assistant State Fire Marshal, if you had anything to add on that.
I don't at this time, no.
Can you tell me maybe either one of you, I think it was mentioned that you might be propagating some regulations based on this bill. Do you have any at this point or any drafts of regulations right now?
To the chair, we are in the discussion and building out the framework and working with those affected agencies in conversation only, where once this is agreed upon and becomes law, is then we could justify putting staff hours into building out that regulation. But that, those conversations are being held, yes. And we do have a basic framework that would, the senator's concerns, it speaks to and addresses all of those issues.
Thank you. I just wanted to note for the record that Senator Vice Chair Klayman has joined us. Welcome to the committee. We're on House Bill 146 relating to fireworks. Let's see. Are there any questions, any further questions for the sponsors designee for the bill before we set this bill aside? Okay, hearing and seeing none, thank you very much for being here today presenting House Bill 146. I will set a deadline for House Bill 146 for this Friday at close, or I'm sorry, next Friday at close business. So that'd be the 26th of April. If you could just send those to Senate State Affairs at akledge.gov. So that will be set aside. We will now take a brief at ease for the next bill. I'd like to call the meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee back to order. We now have before us Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 3. The sponsor is Senator Forrest Dunbar. We heard this bill about 10 days ago. We had limited public testimony, but we will reopen public testimony as somebody is online. Public testimony is now open, and we have one person who's online on the phone. We have Shauna Hegna, the president of Housing Alaskans, Koniag Housing Alaskans. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name and affiliation for the record.
Chumai. Hello. For the record, I am Shauna Hegna. I serve as the president of Koniag and the chair of Housing Alaskans.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Kawasaki and distinguished members of the Senate State Affairs Committee, Tayana Sinok, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. It's not news that Alaska faces a critical shortage of housing. In fact, you all know this. Your employees feel it every time they travel to Juneau for session. This housing shortage that we have has stunted economic investment and development around the state, and in many communities, it's creating a crisis in public safety, health, and education. In fact, my home region of Kodiak, we have heard from our school districts, the fire and police departments, healthcare providers, and private business owners that they're unable to attract and retain talent due to a lack of available or affordable housing. And this is really impacting the safety and well-being of our communities. So Housing Alaskans is a public-private partnership which has proven its ability to pair public funding and private donations to really move the needle on critical housing shortages in Alaska. Last year, Housing Alaskans was able to leverage state funding with private donations to provide gap funding to house more than 80 Alaskan families, both on and off the road system. And we also partnered with the Alaska Municipal League to sponsor a housing track at the annual Alaska Infrastructure Symposium, where we brought in subject matter experts to provide technical assistance to local governments across the state to help them find solutions to their housing needs. It's no surprise to me that this track was the most well-attended track at the entire conference, proving the priority that local municipal governments all across the state are placing on the housing crisis. So I ask today for your continued support to address the housing shortage through Resolution 3. Kayana, thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Hegna. I appreciate the testimony today. Are there any questions for Ms. Hegna? Seeing and hearing none, again, we appreciate you joining us this afternoon. Next, we'll bring up the sponsor of the bill. Would the sponsor like to make any further statement?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, I want to thank the committee for hearing this resolution. It was introduced at the end of actually last session, or the first half of this session. And we've been working with Housing Alaska and Partnerships and others. I think a lot of folks on this panel and on this committee know about the housing shortage. And I'll say that what Ms. Hagner didn't mention, but you all know, is that the capital budget we voted on last week included $6 million for the Housing Alaska Partnership. And very excited about that. I see this resolution as sort of a companion to that investment in that program, with $1 million, as she mentioned. They tipped a number of projects, I think about 80 units, into economic viability and construction just last year. So very excited about that, and thank you so much for hearing this resolution.
Great. Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Are there questions of the sponsor of the bill? Okay, hearing and seeing none, Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. I move Senate Concurrent Resolution Work Draft 33-LS0798/alpha reported out of committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections to the motion? Hearing none, Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 3, Work Draft 33-LS0798A has been reported out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note. We will now take a brief at ease. Okay, I'll go ahead and call the Senate Affairs Committee meeting back to order. We now have before us a House bill, House Bill 265. The sponsor is Representative Vance. We have Representative Vance before us with a brief presentation. We also have a bunch of folks online and in the room for questions, answers, and public testimony. Oh, come forward. If you'd like to come forward and introduce yourself and your staff, and welcome to the State Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Representative Sarah Vance of House District 6 and my policy advisor,
Bob Ballinger, Representative Vance's office.
Thank you for considering House Bill 65. It is an act changing the term child pornography to child sexual abuse material, and it does exactly what the title says. and only what the title says by changing the terms throughout Alaska statutes. So the importance of this bill is that child sexual abuse is a heinous crime that inflicts lasting trauma on its victims. The terminology used to describe such offenses is not merely a matter of semantics, but plays a crucial role in shaping public perception and legal frameworks. In the Alaska statutes, a shift towards the term child sexual abuse material, which is commonly referred to as CSAM, used child pornography is not just linguistics. It is a recognition of the gravity of crime and a step toward more accurate and victim-centric language. Language is a powerful tool that shapes our understanding of various issues. The term child pornography carries misleading connotations, suggesting a consensual act. It fails to capture the essence of the crime when it involves minors, as children cannot provide legal consent. The use of child sexual abuse material serves to correct this misconception, highlighting the non-consensual and abusive nature of the acts depicted. You get an opportunity to hear Sergeant Matt Dubois' testimony on this crucial matter in a few minutes. As a dedicated investigator with the Juneau Police Department, Sergeant Dubois can explain better why this change matters. He has shouldered the weight of confronting the most abhorrent assaults on innocence to safeguard the children of our state. Children who are not merely statistics, but ours. They're yours, and they are mine. Sergeant Dubois is not alone. Other people and prominent organizations in the fight against child exploitation and abuse, including the Alaska Department of Law and Public Safety, have recognized the importance of using accurate and sensitive terminology and are supporting this legislation. They are using the term child pornography less in favor of child sexual abuse material, and you will often hear them, as I said, refer to it as CSAM. This shift in language reflects a commitment to acknowledging the trauma suffered by the victims and challenges of societal perception of these crimes. And listed here are many of the national groups that are pushing for adoption of this language. And I believe our Department of Justice may be included on that list. Regardless of personal opinions, the reality is that pornography exists and is recognized as a First Amendment protected free speech as a legal industry. However, what we are addressing here is a crime, a malicious crime that inflicts harm on children and robs them of their innocence. It's crucial to distinguish this criminal activity, known as child sexual abuse material, from the broader category of pornography. Others have graciously made themselves available to share their insights and answer questions on House Bill 265, but I'm also more than willing to address any questions that you may have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have our first invited testifier is Mr. Matt Dubois, who is available online. And we also have Chief Boss here in person.
Just one correction, actually. Mr. Sergeant Dubois was able to come. Oh. So they're both here.
I apologize. I didn't.
Thank you. And for the record, that was Robert Ballinger, staff to Representative Vance. We have a question from Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. Thank you, Representative Vance, for bringing this legislation forward. I am proud to be a co-sponsor. It looks like it passed the House with overwhelming support, but there was one objection. Can you explain what the concern was?
Thank you, through the Chair, Senator Merrick. The concern was of one individual that thought that we should not be changing the term pornography because of the cultural connotation. And the thought was that it would cause Alaska Statute 11.61.127 to not be in alignment. But that is an inaccurate perception because these materials are still covered under the term of child sexual abuse material. So this law does not change anything else. It doesn't change any of the crimes regarding the production of material or any of the other, the penalties associated. It is just changing the terminology.
Great. Thank you, Representative Vance. Are there any other questions before we go to invited and public testimony? Yeah, Senator Wilikowski.
Is there any difference between the definition of child pornography and the definition of child sexual abuse material?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, no.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Vance. We will now go to a couple of your invited testimony before we open up public testimony. We will go first to Mr. Derek Boss, Chief of Police, Juneau Police Department. If you'd like to come forward, put your name and affiliation on the record, and welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Thank you. I'm Derek Boss with the Juneau Police Department. Also present next to me is Sergeant Matthew Dubois from the Juneau Police Department. Thank you for having us here today, Senators. We appreciate being here. I would like to read a prepared testimony. We also are here to answer questions if you have any. When I began my career as a law enforcement officer, I took an oath to uphold the United States Constitution. At the tail end of that oath was a small phrase that read, and to be the voice of the victim. Today I come before you representing the Juneau Police Department, but more importantly, to ensure that the voice of our child victims is not lost in the pandemonium of our day-to-day lives. House Bill 265 seeks to replace the terminology in our state statutes from child pornography to child sexual abuse material, or CSAM for short. While this modification may seem trite to some, it is, in my opinion, as a law enforcement officer, the delineation is expansive. Throughout my career, I have seen, with far too much frequency, people believe the term pornography implies consent. If not active or willing, there is implied consent that the part of a child victim, that for the child victim's image to be distributed and exploited. Nothing could be further from the truth. The fact is that consent is rarely, if ever, given by the victim for abusive materials to be shared or widely distributed to an ever-expanding unknown audience. When we use words that downplay the significance of such exploitation, we normalize the behaviors that victimize our children. As we normalize exploitive behaviors, victims often feel ostracized and become unwilling or unable to seek help and support. This can create an inescapable, ever-expanding cycle of victimization, which negatively affects more and more children. By accurately labeling these materials as what they are, with the use of the term child sexual abuse material, we as a community send a clear message that our victims matter first and foremost to us. Today, I ask that you let the message be clear that as a state, we reject the normalization, implied or actual, of the exploitation of our children. I would like to introduce Sergeant Matthew Dubois. Sergeant Dubois supervises our criminal investigation unit for the Juneau Police Department. He is an in-house subject matter expert on the investigations relating to the exploitation of children. Sergeant Dubois.
Thank you, Chief, and thank you, everybody. It's an honor to be invited here to speak to you all today. I've been a police officer with the Juneau Police Department for almost 17 years. Since 2015, I've investigated or assisted in many internet crimes against children. I've been on the FBI, U.S. Marshals, ICAC Task Force. I've been exposed to many photographs and videos of child sex abuse material, or currently known by state law as child pornography. There is no such thing as child pornography. I believe language matters. Unclear language can lead to misunderstanding, confusion, harm, or even the language or the acceptance of the language. The continued use of the term child pornography is an example of how harmful words can be. Child sex abuse material, or CSAM, is a result of children being groomed, coerced, and exploited by their abusers. By using the term child pornography, it implies it is a subcategory of legally acceptable pornography rather than what it is, a form of child abuse and a crime. Referring to CSAM as pornography puts the focus on the material as opposed to the impact it has on children. Changing the language to CSAM makes everyone face the impact on children and will recognize the abuse. Continue to go forward using the term child pornography. It minimizes the harm experienced by children. We know the impacts are long-lasting and very devastating. From my training experience, I know child victims who have been abused this way grow up with feelings of shame, guilt, and fear the abuse material will resurface in the future, which some of them say never goes away, or a sense of closure for crimes committed against them. We know this material can remain online forever, and children continue to be re-victimized every time it is viewed, shared, and downloaded. Using the term child pornography hides the true impact on the perpetrator's behavior. Perpetrators are not making or watching pornography. They're abusing children. The term child pornography diminishes the seriousness of the crime. which in some cases can lead to children not getting the support and protection they may need. Using more accurate terminology forces everyone to confront the reality of what is happening. If the language changed to CSAM, or child sex abuse material, everyone would start to recognize the material as abuse. In closing, as a lifetime Alaskan, I've always grew up with the perspective that Alaska was kind of in the eighth grade, meaning kind of behind the lower 48. But in my research and understanding, there are only other few states that have made this change. This is an opportunity for Alaska to lead our nation with this change. Lastly, I'm passionate about making this change. I'm thankful for Representative Vance's work on this, and because of that, I'm going to be vulnerable with you all today. I want to let you all know I attend counseling for exposure to this crime. I don't seek counseling because I'm exposed to pornography, but because I'm exposed to child sex abuse material. In some cases, I have watched children as young as infants being sexually tortured. It is time for Alaska to make a change. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Sergeant Dubois. Are there questions of either of the two? We have a question for Senator Klayman.
Sergeant Dubois, I appreciate your candor with this. You mentioned that only a few other states have taken up this name change. What other states have made the change, if you know?
There's, I believe, it's only like six or seven. I think, here, I got a little help here, if I can find. Connecticut, New Jersey, Virginia, and Missouri.
Cool. So four states?
Correct, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Klayman. Are there any other questions for the invited testimony today? Okay. We'll keep you nearby, though, but we do want to say that we have a handful of folks who are here for questions who are in the room. We have Lisa Purinton from the Department of Public Safety. We have Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. We have Captain Raymond Dunford, who is off-net, the captain at the Director's Office, Alaska State Troopers. But first, I guess there's no questions for any of those folks. We'll go first, then we'll open up public testimony. Thank you very much for your testimony. Public testimony is now open. We'll take folks in the room and then online as they come. We'll start first with Maxine Dugan. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record, and we'll just give you a couple minutes.
Thank you. My name is Maxine Dugan. I'm a currently working prostitute of 30 plus years, and I pretty much plan on working for another 30 plus more. My group is the Community United for Safety and Protection. We're Alaska's sex worker group, current and former sex workers, sex trafficking victims, and our allies. And although the Community United for Safety and Protection supports renaming child pornography to child sexual abuse material in House Bill 265, we also support expanding immunity for clients of sex workers in House Bill 265, and just provides an opportunity to do that. It provides an opportunity to amend the Section 11.66100, Section C, to include Section 2. Right now, under Alaska state law, Alaska was the first state to provide immunity to sex workers to report for victims or witnesses to certain specific crimes that are listed here. And child pornography, hopefully now will be called child sexual abuse material, was one of them. And since then, many other states have gone on to provide this immunity for sex workers and their clients. But Alaska state law does not provide the immunity for clients to be able to report. Oftentimes, clients of sex workers are first responders to situations that they come upon where they see somebody in a situation who maybe doesn't belong there. And they don't have the immunity to be able to go report to the police that somebody is in need of help. And so we want to make sure that all Alaskans are able to have that access to immunity under our state law. So I'm hoping that in passing this bill, you'll consider amending it to include that immunity. Thank you for taking my testimony. If you have any questions.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Dugan. Are there any questions for Ms. Dugan? Okay, seeing and hearing none, we will now move. We're still in the room. We'll move to Amber Nickerson. If you'd like to come forward, state your name and affiliation for the record. Welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Hi, my name is Amber Nickerson, and I'm also a member with CUSP. I am an Anchorage resident. In fact, Senator Clayman is my representative, Senator. I was born and raised here in Juneau, Alaska. I'm here today to ask you to amend HB 265 to extend immunity to clients of sex workers so that they can also report crimes like sex trafficking or murder. I attended the three-week Brian Stephen Smith double murder trial last March in Anchorage, Alaska. It took less than 2 hours for the jury to find him guilty on all 14 counts, including first and second degree murder, tampering with evidence, sexual assault, as well as an aggravator for substantial physical torture of one of his victims. The key testimony came from a sex worker who provided the graphic images and recordings from this predator's phone. She was afraid she would be arrested for prostitution and theft, and she did not know she had immunity under Alaska state law. If the sex worker had known she had immunity possible, additional evidence of his crimes could have been found. It was revealed from the trial that Smith was also texting Ian Calhoun regarding the torture and murder of Kathleen Jo Henry. Were there others Smith might have been sharing his crimes with? Others that may have information, but they're afraid to come forward for fear of arrest. Did you know that here in Alaska, the failure to report a violent crime against an adult is a violation? That is Alaska Statute 1156-767. That's not even a felony conviction. I want you to realize that there are no incentives to report. Right now in Alaska, there's an incentive to stay quiet. I know Alaska can do better. We can include immunity for clients of sex workers in this bill. Immunity for clients plays a crucial role in ensuring justice and encouraging cooperation in legal proceedings. Granting immunity to clients encourages them to provide truthful testimony without fear of incrimination. When clients know they won't face legal consequences, they're more likely to provide timely and valuable information to trials. This cooperation is essential for solving complex cases and bringing perpetrators to justice. Ian Calhoun, Brian Stephen Smith's friend, wasn't granted immunity to testify at his trial. It is very clear from texts and Facebook messages presented in court during the Smith murder trial that Ian had information. Ian pled the fifth, and because of that, information he had was not shared. In further court documents, images found in 2019 in one of Smith's phones, there are pictures of another woman beaten and semi-nude. She still has not been identified. Immunity serves Alaska's public safety goals of upholding justice by allowing prosecutors to pursue cases more effectively. It increases the likelihood of securing convictions against guilty parties. So please amend House Bill 265 to extend immunity to sex worker clients. Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah, great. Thank you, Ms. Nickerson. We do have a question from Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. Thank you for being here, Ms. Nickerson. Was your proposed amendment offered in the House?
It was.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Nickerson. We will now move offline, to Fairbanks, where we have Tara Burns. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name and affiliation for the record.
Hi, I'm Tara Burns, and I'm with the Community United for Safety and Protection. I'm an Alaskan sex worker and a survivor of sex trafficking as a minor in Alaska. I did my graduate research at UAF on the lived experiences and policy recommendations of people in Alaska's sex trade, and I work now as the research and policy director of Coyote, Rhode Island. We support this bill, and we are asking you to amend it by adding clients to the immunity statute that is opened in this bill. In 2019, there was a man who had made disturbing posts on the internet about victimizing sex workers. He also posted reviews saying that he had seen most of us. Some of us decided to try to get his phone number so that we could know which client he was and so that we could warn Indigenous and inexperienced sex workers about him, as that seemed to be who he was targeting. I posed as a customer on a message board and began messaging with him. But he did not start confiding about his sex trafficking of multiple minors in Anchorage until after we had got his phone number and switched to texting, at that point, he was not texting with me, but he was texting with a man who was an ally to local sex workers. When he started texting about trafficking minors, we contacted the FBI. He was charged with and eventually convicted of sex trafficking a minor because we, as sex workers, had immunity to make those reports and because the man that he had texted with was not actually a fellow client. If we had actually been clients instead of sex workers, we would have had to make a difficult choice between potentially being arrested and losing our children and jobs or trying to protect minor victims of sex trafficking in Alaska. Over the 10 years prior to this charge, there were no charges of sex trafficking of actual non-fictitious minors in the sex industry in Alaska. For several of those years, there was the Special Crimes Investigative Unit at the State Troopers and an FBI and APD sex trafficking task force focused on finding minors who were being trafficked, but all of these full-time police investigators did not result in anyone being charged with trafficking a real non-fictitious minor for prostitution in Alaska. Our little Alaskan case study demonstrates that letting clients report sex trafficking without fear of arrest is a much more effective means to combat sex trafficking than police are. You have the power to make these changes and to help put an end to sex trafficking of minors in Alaska. Please do it. And I just want to add that this was not ever voted on in the House. There was a floor amendment that was withdrawn before a vote.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Burns. We appreciate that information. Are there any questions? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, we'll move next to Julie Smith in Fairbanks. Welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yep, we sure can.
Awesome. My name is Julie Smith, and I am calling in from the Lower Tanana Dene Lands in Fairbanks, Alaska. I also support this bill and am also asking you to make these amendments. I don't have as much knowledge or information as the people who came before me who do a lot of work in this field. But what I can tell you is that as a client of the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living, I have heard a lot of horror stories about how hard it is to get all sorts of different crimes taken seriously by law enforcement and people worried about going to law enforcement for a variety of reasons. So I think removing as many stumbling blocks as possible to get as many predators off the street as possible is what is best for public safety. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Smith. It doesn't look like there's any questions here for you. We'll now return back to the room where we have Lori Morton. Lori Morton, if you'd like to come forward, state your name and your affiliation for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Lori Morton. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the State Coalition of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Victim Service Programs. We're in support of House Bill 265. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Words are important. Adjectives help us better understand concepts, bring to mind images associated with them, give us indications of whether something is acceptable or not. They can be clarion calls to action, influence our perceptions. When something is named, power is connected to that name. Pornography used to be seen as sordid, something to be kept in the shadows. Playboy came along, and suddenly pornography seemed a little more glamorous. Famous people posed in it. Pornography was something you could more openly talk about. There was still a seamy side, hustler movies that were made, and child pornography was still in the dark. You were a deviant if you viewed children sexually. Now, though, the word pornography, shortened to porn, is seen as a way to describe many things. Food is an example. Instagram says food porn is your guide to all things delicious. Food porn is described as simple, attractive, visual, Its glamorized visual presentations of cooking or eating in advertisements, blogs, cooking shows, the context of when the word porn is used has changed. Flower porn is a perfume. Flower porn also describes a new way to look at flower bouquets, bold, modern, more than a little bit cheeky. Flower porn ditches the traditional bouquet for designer arrangements. The meanings attached to the concept of porn has changed. How could porn be bad? Child porn may lead to images of young boys or girls in seductive poses, maybe with soft lighting or flowing dresses or suggestive gestures. It may be easy to think of it in neutral or at least not harmful ways. Child pornography is anything but those images. It is not pretty. It is not provocative. It's not something to be glossed over. This is graphic. It's anal or vaginal penetration of babies and toddlers. It's images depicting children being tied up and beaten, urinated and defecated on. It's preteen children stroking adult sexual organs. It's abuse. It's child sexual abuse. Children don't ask to be put in these positions. They don't understand why they're being hurt. Who could understand that? They don't deserve to have these criminal acts committed against them, and they are criminal acts, and they should be named as such. Naming the material child sexual abuse material rightly names the actions taken to create these materials. We urge your swift passage of the bill.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Morton. Are there questions for Lori Morton? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, we do have, again, a couple people who are online and in the room for questions only. We have Lisa Purinton, Department of Public Safety. We also have Casey Schroeder with the Department of Law, and we have Captain Raymond Dunford with the Alaska State Troopers. Do we have any questions for any of those three? Okay. Before we set House Bill 265 aside, I'd like to invite Representative Sarah Vance back up and Mr. Ballinger, if you'd like to just make any final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Sarah Vance, House District 6. And I would like to clarify for the record, I handed the wrong sheet of paper to the sergeant earlier. The states who have adopted CSAM is Vermont, Utah, Arkansas, and California. And states that are working on adopting is Connecticut, New Jersey, Virginia, and Missouri.
Hmm. Great. Senator Klayman.
Wasn't counting as you spoke. How many states is that?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, four states have adopted CSAM. And four states are considering CSAM.
Thank you. Great, thank you. Did you have any last comments? Maybe did you have any thoughts on the comments about immunity and anything like that? I don't know if it's necessarily part directly of this bill, but if you just had any comments on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There has been a lot of conversation about that with other bills that I'm working on regarding sex trafficking and protecting the exploitation of children and the vulnerable in Alaska. This bill specifically is one that the only policy decision that we have to make is changing the terms. And it's one that, as you've heard, will have a profound impact on the way that we perceive this abuse of children. It is my preference that we keep it to that decision alone. There are many other criminal bills that the question that was presented could be a part of the conversation. I can go on and on and on about all of those bills and the significant changes I believe that this body will have an opportunity to discuss. But for the matter of this bill, let's keep this the focus on updating the terms around what this act is and protecting our vulnerable children.
Great. Thank you, Representative Vance. Are there any other comments or questions? Just like to thank you for bringing this bill forward to the State Affairs Committee. We will take this up at a future, very soon future meeting. We will go ahead and set Senate Bill, let me close public testimony, but let me just say that if anybody has any testimony they'd like to submit to the committee, please do so at senatestateaffairs@akledge.gov, senatestateaffairs@akledge.gov, and we will set House Bill 265 aside and take a brief at ease for the next bill. Okay, we'll call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting back to order. We now have before us House Bill 286, Crime Victim Restitution, by Representative Julie Kloom. I'd like to welcome Julie and her staff, Jordan Wright, to the front table. And welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Julie Kloom. I am representative for House District 11, South Anchorage Hillside. And thank you for listening to the bill today. So House Bill 286 seeks to make clarification in the current Alaska statute regarding victim restitution for crimes. It would clarify that lost income, child care, elder care, transportation, or any other expenses incurred during the victim's participation in legal action related to the case would be eligible for restitution. It strengthens the ability of victims to receive compensation for costs related to their time spent in court. And this is particularly relevant to cases involving domestic violence, as the continuation of court cases involving restitution can result in a perpetuation of the cycle of abuse. So this bill came to me from the Office of Victims' Rights. I had visited them in the interim. And they expressed frustration in trying to get specific restitution to victims. And so worked with them to put the bill forward. We worked with Department of Law and the courts to get the wording right. And they're here to answer questions as well. And my staff, Jordan Wright, does have a short presentation or sectional analysis, whatever the chair would prefer.
Great. Thank you, Representative Kloom. If you'd like to just state your name and affiliation for the record, welcome to the committee, and I guess you have a couple slides in the deck.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. My name is Jordan Wright, staff to Representative Julie Kloom. I have a short slideshow. So the Office of Victims' Rights is created similarly to an Inspector General's office, and in that it is part of the legislative branch to avoid any potential conflicts with other state offices. The Office of Victims' Rights provides advocacy in court on behalf of victims and investigates any complaints that they have and works with various criminal justice organizations to get information. The Office of Victims' Rights is funded by forfeited PFD checks from convicted criminals under Alaska Statute 4323.005. House Bill 286 would clarify the current statute and make it easier for prosecutors to regain compensation for various different expenses incurred, including lost income, child care, transportation, and anything related to them going to court or being part of an investigation. And yeah, the purpose of the language is to strengthen their ability to ask for compensation for victims.
Great, thank you, Mr. Wright. Let's see, it's a pretty short bill. Do we have any questions for the sponsor or designee? Well, yep, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a current definition for restitution in existing law right now?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, I believe there is, but I would rather have somebody from the Department of Law or courts answer that to make sure it's correct. If you don't mind having them come up.
Yeah, we'll call somebody back up here in a bit. There are any other further questions? Senator Klayman.
I appreciate the intent of this bill. It's what I keep hearing from victims is not that they're interested in restitution, but I keep hearing that the funds that we have available, even from dividends that are forfeited, and my memory, if it's accurate, is that for prisoners who are in custody, that this isn't the only part of state government that's seeking some portion of their dividend while they're in prison. But what I keep hearing from victims is this kind of sense that they were hoping for restitution, and many of them have experienced very significant, not just kind of personal losses, but actually pretty significant financial losses. And they come into this criminal system and think, well, you know, the restitution deal and these compensation funds are going to make me whole again. And the communication I always get from them is, it didn't make me whole. And I spent sometimes days and sometimes weeks trying to get some restitution. And then 2 years later or 3 years later, they say, well, I got $500 or I got $1,500. I mean, Angela Harris, the woman who was stabbed at the library, I remember talking with her about what she got from Office of Victims' Rights, and I think it was like $2,200 or $3,200. And I think this is great stuff. I just wonder where is the point at which we're creating this sense for the victims that this system is going to make them whole when there's nothing about our current state economics that will make them whole. And I'm just wondering how you respond to those concerns. I mean, that doesn't change the fact that I'm very highly like to support this legislation. I just, every time folks come and talk about what's the compensation for victims, the most common answer I get from victims is I spent a lot of time for the compensation, and when the compensation finally came, it wasn't very much.
Right.
So through the chair to Senator Klayman, thank you for the question. That was definitely something we talked a lot about, and it is a piece that needs to be addressed. One hopeful thing, and maybe the department can speak more to this, but I got involved with all this because I'm the subcommittee chair with the Department of Public Safety. And so I started digging into all the victim services that they were addressing. And there is a lot of changes going on in the Department of Public Safety around victimization. They're pulling out a whole separate division. And there's a lot of changes going on with victim restitution. But you're not wrong that the money that is there for victims is definitely, it's limited, and there has been a lot of hoops that victims have to go through to actually access the money. There's limits as well to what they can ask depending on the crime, and so I know that those things are being worked on with the Department of Public Safety to try to rectify some of those things. I think the Office of Victims' Rights was just really frustrated with that. They couldn't even get the ball rolling. They couldn't even request. Some of these were being denied or not being able to be requested. And then the funding part, I think you're absolutely right, still needs to be corrected and needs to be worked on for sure.
Follow up?
Senator Clayman.
And I suppose the second part of that question, which again doesn't really go to the merits of that bill, but the Office of Victims' Rights is a legislative branch, and I think I wasn't around when between the court system and the executive branch and the legislative branch, somehow it was determined that Office of Victims' Rights would be a legislative branch instead of one of the other two branches of government. But the descriptions you gave about public safety and what public safety do, and it reminds me that we need a lot more resources in rural Alaska, where we have the most horrific rates of sexual abuse and sexual assault in the country. And it's beyond embarrassing. And so there's a part of me that when you're talking about how can we do more for public safety, part of my reaction is in a budget short world, why aren't we getting more money to public safety so they can prosecute people and do investigations? Because, I mean, I really do appreciate the importance of compensating victims where we can afford to. But the other thing I hear more from victims is, why can't you get the perpetrator? And if I could get more resources to catching the perpetrator, and that meant less money for victim restitution, which is already not adequate. I mean, I do have to say and this isn't really a question, I'm just kind of pontificating. But I do have to say, if I had that choice between less money for Office of Victims' Rights and more money for public safety to get more investigators in the field where just horrible things are happening in our state, I would put first priority to get that to public safety. And
again, Julie Colomb through the chair to Senator Clayman. I think that was expressed a lot, at least in my subcommittee on the House side. There was a lot of increases to the Department of Public Safety, including 10 new VPSOs. There was a lot of requests there around rural Alaska for that very reason. There's new investigators in Bethel for sexual assault, child sex crimes. There is a lot, at least on my side of things, there was a lot of increases to those to address that. But we heard that from many people that really needed to be addressed. Also, the funding right now, and this is way before my time, most of the restitution is coming from these permanent fund checks from people incarcerated. Maybe that's not where we need to stay. Maybe we need to expand where that restitution money comes from. I know that the Victim Crime Compensation Board has added staff. They're getting a lot more efficient, a lot more streamlined. That in the past didn't seem like a lack of funding, but more just a lack of personnel to deal with the restitution. So I think there's several things going on to address both the conviction part and the compensation part.
Thank you, Senator Clayman. Senator Wilikowski.
It says line 10, restitution to a victim or other person, and then it references other person throughout the statute. Well, is there a definition of other person, who another person could be?
Can you tell me what line you're on?
Line 10, well, restitution to a victim or other person injured by the offense.
Yeah, so through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, I think it's referring to the list, above it. So it says the court shall, on line 4, when presented with credible evidence, unless the victim or other person expressly declines restitution or defendant. And then it goes down to line 8, says it includes the person injured by the offense to a public, private, or nonprofit organization as provided or will be providing counseling, medical, shelter services to the victim or other person injured by the offense. So, I mean, again, you can get the court's interpretation of this, but to me, like some of the stories from OVR was those people that were affected by the actual offense. So it could be the person that was actually involved in the crime or let's say you lost a loved one to the crime, it would be the family, the effects on the family. But I'm not a lawyer, so that's why.
Senator Wilikowski, and I just wanted to let folks know that we do have some folks for invited testimony. We have Kathy Hansen, who is with the Office of Victims' Rights, might also be able to answer those questions.
All right, I'll save it till then. Thanks.
Okay. Are there any questions of the sponsor? Yep, go ahead, Senator Klayman.
Last question, and this is specific to the bill. On page 2, lines 6 and 7, you're excluding the language including loss of income. Why is that?
Through the chair to Senator Klayman, we're excluding or including?
Well,
it says loss
of under income. The statutory language, when you put it in large capitals and put it in brackets, it means you're taking it out of what was existing statute.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering why we're taking that out.
Yeah, so through the chair to Senator Klayman, I think that's the previous version. That was a mistake that was made, and it was corrected. It was corrected in the House State Affairs.
The S version. The S
version. I'm on the B version.
I'm on
the S version.
Oh, S version. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we have a different.
I'm asking questions about the wrong version.
I think we have the right version. It's S version of the bill, and it's not in there.
I apologize for being not up to date on the version.
Okay, let's see. Are there any other questions of the sponsor of the bill or Mr. Wright at this time? If not, we will go ahead and open up. I think we have some folks who are here for invited testimony. Oh, actually, we just have one person online for invited testimony, and that's Ms. Kathy Hansen, Senior Staff Attorney with the Office of Victim Rights, calling to us from Anchorage. Welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee, Ms. Hansen.
Good afternoon, Chair Kawasaki, Senators. I'm privileged to have served as a Victims' Rights Attorney at the Office of Victims' Rights for the past 20 years. The changes to the restitution statute proposed in HB 286 were requested by our office. OVR attorneys' duties include providing legal representation to crime victims. We advise crime victims whether and what to request for restitution if there are legal disagreements about restitution. Courts can hold restitution hearings and hear testimony and make legal rulings and then issue final written restitution judgments. There were two recent Court of Appeals cases that called into question whether courts could award crime victims restitution for lost wages to attend court proceedings. Those two cases are unpublished, Keene Smith versus State, the site is 2022-WL-322-6305, and Seeley versus State, the site is 2023-WL-278-3265. Those were decided in 2022 and 2023. The reason we requested this bill would be to have the legislature make it clear that lost wages that crime victims incur to attend criminal court proceedings when they are the victim should be a direct expense that the courts award restitution judgments for. I want to make it clear that this doesn't cost anyone any money. It's just a piece of paper from a court saying the defendant caused the loss and owes the money to the crime victim. Crime victims in Alaska have a constitutional right to attend all criminal proceedings, those that they're subpoenaed to testify at, and also any hearing that the defendant has the right to be present at. We don't want a situation where victims who may have less means have to choose whether to incur the financial loss and bear the financial loss to attend a court hearing, or exercise their constitutional right to attend and watch criminal court proceedings. The proposed language in HB 286 tracks similar existing federal law for restitution awards in federal criminal cases. The language proposed will give specific direction to judges and prosecutors statewide in Alaska as to how restitution awards should be made. This would result in predictability and uniformity and fairness in restitution judgments for all victims. and would ensure that victims receive compensation if restitution orders are paid for foreseeable compensable costs for crime victims to attend court hearings and other expenses that would allow them to attend court hearings. We're asking for this bill to be passed because it would minimize the need for victims to have to go to contested court hearings to assert these rights and ask for these types of restitution. And it would minimize resources needed for courts to litigate at the trial level and at the appellate level these kinds of questions. There is another recent Alaska Supreme Court decision decided on April 12, 2024. It's called Brennan Grubb, G-R-U-B-B, where the Alaska Supreme Court recognized that the Alaska legislature consistently over the past 50 years has expanded rights for crime victims to receive restitution and reversed the Court of Appeals on a decision that was limiting a victim's right to restitution. But I just want to note that that criminal case opened in 2014, and the Alaska Supreme Court in 2024 is deciding whether or not the victim can get restitution. And the litigation is not complete. It will still continue. It will go back to the Court of Appeals and maybe back to the Supreme Court again. So, you know, this is real financial loss that victims suffer, and we're hoping that they won't have to wait for even a decision about whether they should be entitled to the money in the form of a civil judgment issued in a criminal case. Another example is the David Grunwald homicide. Edie Grunwald was David Grunwald's mother. She had to attend many court hearings involving many co-defendants for proceedings that lasted more than 2 years. And there is an actual controversy about whether she can get restitution ordered in that case for time that she lost in wages to attend those court proceedings. I know that Senator Klayman had a question about funding, and I just wanted to make it clear that typically from the pot of money of forfeited criminal PFDs, the entire operating budget for the Office of Victims' Rights is about 1% or less of that pot of money. And I'm happy to answer any other questions, and thank you for your time in considering this bill.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Hansen. I do believe that Senator Wilikowski had a question on definitions.
Yeah, thank you. It sounds like this is a pretty heavily litigated area. And I, just correct me if I'm wrong in sort of how this procedurally works. Someone is a victim of a crime. They go ahead. There's a conviction. And then the judge, and then the victim would have to provide evidence of the damages that they've suffered. And this is just an attempt to define what restitution they're entitled to. Is that a fair statement?
Chairman Kawasaki, yes. The defendant would be sentenced, and then the victim would have the opportunity to submit documentation and a total amount requested to the prosecutor's office that would also be discovered to the defense. Defense could object within 30 days, and if there was not an agreement, then there would be a hearing scheduled at which the victim would have to come back to court and provide live sworn testimony with the defendant present and answer questions about the losses, and then the court would make a decision about whether and what amount to award.
Yeah, Senator Wilikowski.
So here, is this the sort of restitution that an individual, a victim, would typically get, compensation for lost income, child care, elder care, transportation, other expenses? Is there any like pain and suffering or any other type of restitution that courts have ordered in the past?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, under current Alaska law, non-economic damages such as punitive damages and pain and suffering that might be awarded as a financial judgment in a civil case are not permitted to be ordered in a criminal case. So it would be economic damages only.
Follow up.
Okay. So then here's, I want to ask you a hypothetical that, so it talks about other person. I know that's in the original statute. Hypothetically, someone is a victim of assault and they're out of work for 3 months. And during that time that they're out of work, their employer loses income. would the employer be considered an other person who has lost money who could then apply for restitution under this?
Through the chair, theoretically, yes. And to answer the other questions presented earlier, I do not believe there is a current legal definition of restitution in the Alaska statute. And what we have in AS 1255-045 is it. The phrase other person is designed to include other people who are not statutory victims who are harmed and suffer financial loss as a result of the crime. It could even be an insurance company, and that's by appellate case law. In your example, Senator, through the chair, the employer theoretically could come forward with a loss and have that litigated in a restitution hearing, assuming that the defendant didn't agree that it should be paid, and then the judge would make the decision. Of course, Office of Victims' Rights would not represent anyone who's not a statutory victim, so that is not something that Office of Victims' Rights would assist with litigation.
Senator Wilikowski, follow-up.
And I'll just say that seems like an extremely broad definition, and I'm wondering if we might not want to change that somehow. I can certainly see victims' families, but I think if you're going to have employers or insurance companies come in and start crowding out what should money that should be going to the victim, I mean, theoretically, a government could come in and say, hey, you lost your job, and therefore we have a loss of tax revenue. I mean, it just seems extremely broad. And has there been any discussion about narrowing or better defining what other person should be?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I'm not seeing abuses of that statute in my experience over the last 20 years. I'm admittedly seeing a small percentage of cases in which victims contact OVR for legal representation. But there is a reported decision called LONIS, L-O-N-I-S, that covers whether an insurance company could seek restitution and why, that I could supply the committee with to look at.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. If you could send that to senatestateaffairs@akledge.gov, I'll make sure to give it to all the members and put it into the record. Senator Wilikowski, did you have a further question? Senator Clayman has a question.
I have a question for Ms. Mead from the court system, if she could come up.
We'll call her up. And can you hold on for a second?
Sure.
We're gonna put her on hold for just 1 second. Are there any other questions for Ms. Hansen? I guess I do have a question for you, Ms. Hansen. The way I see this definition about restitution to include these things, so compensation of lost income, child care, elder care, transportation, that seems like an exclusive list rather than an inclusive list. I'm just curious if there was thoughts that maybe something that was more broad as a generalization would be better than specifying something like child care, elder care, those types of things. I don't know what else there would be as far as restitution goes, but seems like there might be something out there we're just not thinking about, and then we'd have to fix the law at some future point in time.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that's an excellent question. A couple of reasons we had it lined out this way is that if it mirrored the federal statute, we could look at reported decisions from federal jurisdictions and use those by analogy to urge the Alaska courts to apply the victim restitution law uniformly. So that might save money and resources. We had discussed including a phrase that said including but not limited to solve that problem, but that was run through Ledge Legal and decided not to include that. So I don't know if the bill sponsor might have more information about that.
This is Julie Colombe. I don't have any more information than what she said.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Hansen. Are there further questions for the Office of Victims' Rights? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and open up public testimony. We have a couple people here in the room right now. We have Okay, we have one person that's on or here to testify, and that is Brenda Stanfill. If she'd like to come forward to testify on House Bill 286. And again, we do have Casey Schroeder with the Department of Law, Nancy Mead with the court system here for questions, and we'll call up Nancy here shortly. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Brenda Stanfill. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We represent 24 member programs across the state doing direct services with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this very important piece of legislation. And while it's a very short bill, it's a very powerful bill. So I had the privilege of being appointed to the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, and I can't remember what year it was, but it was a while ago. And one of the things that we did was we really looked at victims, what they were getting out of the criminal justice system or not getting out of the criminal justice system. We traveled around the state. We had focus groups. We heard from people. And one of the things that we heard very loud and clear is, I'm never made whole. So in 1994, voters adopted an amendment to the state constitution to provide crime victims in Alaska with a right to receive restitution from an offender when they have been victimized. And our current law requires the court to order a defendant to make restitution as long as credible evidence is presented. But currently, the challenge is knowing what can be requested that qualifies for restitution. So while the current statute expressly states counseling, medical, or shelter that has been provided, it does not clearly lay out what else could be included in an order of restitution. And this has created challenges for victims in knowing what they can request. It also creates some confusion from the prosecutor's office in knowing what to ask victims about the impact of the crime so they know what to request for restitution and what credible evidence they need to provide. The passage of 286 would ensure that victims clearly understand they have the right to lost income, to the child care that they have to pay, to any elder care expenses they would have for people they are responsible for, any transportation, and then there is the words other expenses. So it leaves a bit of a gray, a nebulous area in there for those things that come up that we may not have thought about. And this is while they both participate in the investigation and the prosecution of the offense, including attendance at court proceedings. Oftentimes, this is something that there has been some question about whether that is part of the damages that happened to them because of the crime. We feel that this would provide an excellent guide for future restitution requests. One of the things about the study we did on victims' impact of crime, we found that they were not collecting a lot of restitution. So you're correct, Senator Klayman, in that analysis of that is still a very frustrating thing for victims. But there's also something about the courts acknowledging that that is due to them that matters. In studies on restitution, it has shown that restitution reduces the long-term harm caused to victims. It helps to foster the victim's trust in the justice system, and it increases the victim's willingness to report crimes in the future. So we encourage you to pass HB 286 that clearly identifies what is considered restitution in Alaska to ensure that victims can be restored. So thank you for taking the time for my testimony.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Stanfill. Are there questions? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, thanks for being here. We did have a request to hear Ms. Mead from the court system. If you could come forward. Okay, I'll go ahead and close public testimony, but just say that public testimony is always available if you'd like to send it to senatestateaffairs@akledge.gov. We'll go ahead and close, though, for today. And welcome, Nancy Mead.
So, Ms. Mead, my question is, can you provide us some information on how much restitution is paid, or some data about how much restitution is collected, how much is paid out on an annual basis, and how many people receive those payments?
Through the chair to Senator Klayman, the court does collect restitution on behalf of victims. It's something that 1.5 people in our administrative office does pretty much full time in order to help the victims not have to go through court processes to try to, you know, collect on debts that are tough to collect upon. It is true, however, if somebody is incarcerated, they do not get their PFD. Those incarcerated persons' PFDs
go to a different fund, as you're probably aware, and do not go towards restitution. The person isn't getting their PFD. So if I have a criminal case and have a restitution judgment for, you know, $10,000, say, but the person is incarcerated for 5 years, what the court does, what our staff does as a matter of routine, is garnish their PFD every year, but for the first 5 years, we get zero because that person doesn't have a PFD. The PFD for incarcerated individuals goes to that fund that is, I believe, the subject of other bills, and those funds pay for other things that happen in the state. So those aren't available for restitution. The person isn't getting their PFD. So as a result, if somebody is incarcerated, the first time that there can be money garnished from their PFD is the year that they get out of jail. Now, some people well imprisoned are earning money. They earn a small dollar per hour or something for jobs that they have in jail. And occasionally, DOC does send that money to the court's restitution unit so we can go ahead and forward that on to the victim. That is not of huge consequence, but I just wanted to ensure you know that there isn't anything to collect upon during the time that a person is incarcerated. And I'm talking about this usual case. Sometimes defendants have money and you can, a defendant willingly pays restitution. And that happens sometimes, but with the kind of crimes that you're probably thinking about, not very much. For example, with guiding in Fish and Game, if somebody owes restitution, those are almost always paid because guides are, is a very general matter, have means, maybe more than folks who are incarcerated for crimes under Title 11. And that is just a very gross statement, but we've found that certain types of crimes, the people have means and pay their restitution. So I do want to say that restitution orders are issued most often on behalf of businesses. Our number one victim who is awarded judgments is Walmart, and that's because they have a lot of things stolen from them, and they win those cases, and Walmart is the number one victim. The number two victim that we give money to after we collect is the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. So VCCB isn't giving, quote, restitution to people. They're giving them bridge money, more or less, right away to help them with expenses after a crime. And now VCCB is one of the other persons covered by the statute who have expended money because of this incident. So the court might say the defendant has to pay $20,000 for the costs of the broken leg that they caused or the head injury and medical expenses, and you have to give $5,000 to VCCB because they gave bridge money. The total restitution judgment is $5,000. So when the court collects, again, after the person gets out of jail, almost always both of those restitution orders would try to be satisfied. So that's the reason that it's hard to get restitution right away if the person goes to jail, of course. Over the last 5 calendar years, going back to 2019, I can see that about $7 million total dollars were ordered in all the various restitution judgments. There were about 1,500 restitution orders totaling $7 million, and about $2.5 million were paid. So that I'm talking 36% of the restitution orders, the money got to the victim, which, it isn't 100%, but it isn't zero. The problem is a lot of defendants don't have money. The best we can do is go after their PFD on behalf of the victim. And then, of course, as in more recent years, say 2023, so far we've only collected 13%, but that number will rise as those defendants are released from prison and we can execute on their PFDs. And there are state agencies that collect that are victims of restitution or other persons. And under the statute, that is, there's legislative intent from when this statute was passed that says it should be very broadly applied to the court, by the court. And that's the Lonis decision that Ms. Hansen referred to. But DHSS, for example, is a big victim or other person. 65 times they had judgments for restitution, and those are largely Medicaid fraud cases. So those sometimes do get paid because sometimes those victims have means. State Farm Insurance is big, Fred Meyer, Sportsman's Warehouse. So it's most often theft that we're able to collect the restitution judgment for. And I hope that was helpful and responsive.
Yeah, that's really helpful, actually. And Senator Klayman has a question.
So if you take the average scenario, 7 million in restitution ordered, 2.3, if one wants to go revenue, 2.5 million collected, how much, do you have any idea of the resources that we're spending, not counting private counsel and places, but just how much are we spending in terms of court resources and public defender and prosecutor resources to collect, say, $2.5 million?
Through the chair to Senator Klayman, I would say that it's super efficient. The public defender doesn't get involved. The state prosecutor doesn't get involved. It used to be done by the collections unit within the Department of Law. That was dissolved 6-7 years ago. And with the threat of nobody doing it, basically the court didn't want 1,500 victims coming and saying, I have this order. How do I execute on it? How do I get a PFD? So we dedicate that 1.5 persons. And that is really the cost of getting these victims the money. The court feels that it is a good thing for us to do to ensure that those orders can be fulfilled efficiently. We do a global writ to the PFD and have a system going with the PFD to serve those writs of execution on them, garnishments rather.
Follow-up, Senator Klayman.
So is it fair to say as a practical matter, it may not be in the scheme of things large compensation for being a victim of crime, but at least we're getting a pretty good return on the state investment to get that money. One could say the money isn't a lot, but at least we're not spending a lot of money to get the money.
Through the chair to Senator Klayman, I see what you're saying, and I would agree. And actually, it's something the court system's pretty proud that we're able to provide with 1.5 persons. And the hardest part is keeping track of the victims' addresses.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. Ms. Mead, can you just tell me a little bit more about how much money do the, quote, other persons get versus the person, the victim of the potential crime? You mentioned that Walmart, Sportsman's Warehouse, those folks are entitled to some of this restitution, and they often get it. Can you kind of just broadly talk about that?
To the chair, they would be the victim of the theft, right? They're the ones who absolutely lost the money. So the other person was added by the legislature back when they passed this statute, and it's discussed in that loaning case because the legislature said, we want anyone who suffered any which way because of this crime to be reimbursed by that defendant to the extent we can for an economic damage. And it has to be, caused by the crime, and the other case that Ms. Hansen referred to that was just decided sort of refined that a little bit further and talked about it has to be a reasonably foreseeable consequence of the crime. So when you break somebody's legs, I guess it's reasonably foreseeable that they might have medical bills. The insurance company might have to shell out. So those are all compensable victims. I would say that Lowe's is the direct victim of the theft when something is stolen. And the state is a direct victim if somebody commits Medicaid fraud and takes state funds that weren't theirs. So the or other person is simply intended to ensure that it doesn't exclude anybody who suffered.
And then, so if in the case where a person were, like say a person were hurt or harmed, they were injured by the offense and then they had, they weren't able to go to work, so they would get compensation. But would the company that's deprived of their labor also be entitled to compensation?
To the chair, under this bill, certainly clarifies that the person's lost income would be considered restitution. And as I say, the Supreme Court just came out of came out with the case that said if you lose wages in the future, that is a reasonably foreseeable consequence. And yes, it is. It does qualify as restitution because we do it broadly. Now, the question whether that person's employer who lost sales, for example, because they didn't have a salesperson, I mean, that would be a judgment question for the court. That is possibly too attenuated to be a reasonably foreseeable consequence of injuring somebody. But that would be decided after full briefing by lawyers.
Great. Thank you. Are there any further questions, Ms. Mead? If not, do you have any last statements you'd like to make, Representative Colomb?
Thank you, Chair. Just briefly, I did not put this bill forward to fix all the restitution issues of the state. I know that it's complicated and there's a lot of problems. I think this is just one step that we can make to make sure victims get their restitutions. But thank you for letting me present the bill.
Great. Thank you, Representative Klum. It looks like there's a question, Senator Wilkowski.
I know we're over time, I'll be quick. But so just two things. Number one, it says restitution to a victim or other person injured by the offense includes. Does that mean it's limited to? It sort of gets back to that question that was asked before. Like, is that all you can get, includes compensation? Or could there be more than this?
I would rather have somebody from the Department of Law.
Okay. I mean, it's your intent. It's your bill. So yeah. The intent of the sponsor is critical.
Right.
And
well,
this is going to be litigated. I can guarantee you that.
Oh. So through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, there was a reference to, we were saying that limited to and whether, and there were conversations in the other body about that too. The interpretation that I was receiving is that it's not limiting to it just the things listed. It's simply if you take that out and you set the original statute, my understanding is that it was too broad and these things were, there were a lot of problems with these things being requested and having to come back. I did not get the impression that it limits to those things. It's just that those needed to be specified on top of what the original statute covered.
Just to clarify, it could be compensation for value of lost income, child care, elder care, transportation, but it also could be more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So one other question.
Yep.
And so it says includes compensation for the value of lost income. Is that all the value of lost income? Is that, or does that only apply to incurred during the victim's or other person's participation in the investigation? You can read it two ways.
Yeah.
So you have a series of things. You said includes compensation for value of lost income, child care, elder care, transportation, other expense. And then you go, and other expenses incurred during the victim's or other person's participation. Is it, for example, is it all child care that you might incur because of the offense, or is it child care only incurred during the victim's or other person's participation in the investigation or prosecution? You see what I'm saying?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, I think I know what you're saying. So are you asking whether it's just to what is the litigation part of the crime? Or
I'm asking, let's take child care. Let's say somebody gets hurt, they have child care for 2 months that incurred. Do they get the full 2 months, or do they only get child care during the victim or other person's participation in the investigation or prosecution of the offense or attendance in a court proceeding?
So through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, it's my understanding is everything related to the litigation. Now, if it has something to do with, so if the person is harmed and they can't take care of their children, and then they need also child care to go to the trial, to go to all the litigation, my understanding is all that's included. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Colomb. Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. That takes us to the end of the committee meeting, and I appreciate everybody staying over for 10 extra minutes. We will set House Bill 286 aside for a future hearing. Yes, thank you. Next, just wanted to announce a couple things. An amendment deadline for House Bill 3 regarding gold and silver specie, Senate Bill 177 regarding artificial intelligence, ban Senate Bill 162, which I don't know what it is. Senate Bill 262. I think it's Senate Bill 262 AI Task Force for Friday at 5 p.m. It concludes the meeting today. I also wanted to make an announcement on Tuesday, April 23rd. We will have before us a first hearing on House Bill 81 by Representative Rauscher, transfer of title upon death. Senate Bill 223, second hearing, Assistant Adjutant General appointment, including public testimony. We'll have a second hearing on Senate Bill 262, Artificial Intelligence Task Force, with public testimony. We will have Senate Bill 177, third hearing on AI deepfake, cybersecurity, and data transfers, along with public and invited testimony. And we will have a second hearing on House Bill 3, Gold and Silver Specie as Legal Tender, by Representative McCabe. And we will also have public testimony available. Without any other business before the Senate State Affairs Committee, this meeting is adjourned. The time now is 5:13 p.m.